Okay, good enough. We can begin. Okay, so normally these teen weekends, since we started in 1996, the afternoon time would be a time of taking the teens up into the forest and having some time of solitude and just being out in the forest on your own and in a natural environment. And what's natural today is blistering heat, so it's not much fun. And so we're going to do our afternoon program here in the hall, and don't really have a whole lot of say clarity, ideas, opinions of how it should be. But I think if we take the opportunity, I thought I'd do was just give a bit of an overview or a sense of why I think the say practice in the forest is a good thing, and then just plant some seeds for reflection. Also, hopefully, people will have questions, and we can just engage in some discussion and have some ideas of what, or even what we even do in a monastery like this. People probably have some questions. So, being out in the forest, of course, this is called the Thai forest tradition, and it's something that is definitely not unique to Thailand or unique to say somewhat modern time. It's something that since the time of the Buddha, this practice and lifestyle has been going on in secluded areas, and it's something that the Buddha praised, taking time to be in quiet places, being in secluded environments, being away from the busyness of even a village life, all of the, let alone city life. So being able to step back from the various entanglements and duties that one has, and all the different kind of webs of relationships that one has, and being able to step back and then be in a simple environment of nature, and that gives an opportunity to see a bit more clearly. Well, what's my mind doing? what does it feel like when there isn't somebody to talk to, somebody to phone, to text, to some device to check what's happening, even if it's just for a couple hours. And of course, that's say part of our life here is when somebody comes to the monastery and they want to commit to being here, one of the things that we ask them to do is to give up their social media accounts, give up their devices, be ready to just live from day to day, moment to moment, with themselves and with the community that they're training with. So that's a part of a training that helps one to start and see, well, what does my mind do? What's the nature of this attachment? Because it's easy to sort of say, oh, yeah, I'm just mindful and unattached. And so long as you're getting what you want, and then everything's fine. But as soon as that there's any kind of obstacle to that, then, okay, there's a problem. And it feels uncomfortable. It's starting feeling kind of antsy or uncertain, or having that feeling of what do I do? And of course, being in a quiet environment is just a it's a backdrop to the activity of the mind, and you start to be able to see more clearly. Okay, what's my mind actually doing? And so that spending time in the forest, and for probably a lot of you have gone camping, gone hiking, and those are generally times when you do step back from one's sort of so-called normal life. People obviously see the benefit because places like REI and North Face, they keep doing well. So there, everybody keeps, at least they buy the equipment. I don't know what they do with it sometimes. a forest monastery is very much a place where one's surrounded by nature, and that's up until yesterday afternoon, for the previous, I think, 10, 11 days, I was on retreat. Here at the monastery, summertime, during the wintertime, we have a three-month period of retreat where we really step back, and it's kind of a group practice, and we have time for solitude, we have time for group practice, focusing on meditation and the teachings. In the summertime, we'll have a shorter period, so we usually have 2 weeks of solitude, and my routine up until last night was that I would, I'd get up in the morning and I'd do some exercises, meditation, and come down, and they'd take. Leave some breakfast in my office. Have a cup of tea. There would be some odds and ends for a meal. I put it together. Just some vegetables and fruit. Get on my treadmill. Do some walking exercise. Have a shower. Head up the hill, and I'd be on my own through to the next morning. And even in the morning, I don't really see anybody. Everybody knows I'm a retreat, so they tend to leave me alone. And it's delightful. Really, that opportunity just to step back and meditate and read and reflect on the Buddha's teachings and on practice. So these are aspects of say our life, the rhythm of our life. A lot of it's in community, but then there's also time for solitude, and even during those times of solitude, I remember one time I did a year of retreat in a monastery in England, and in the forest, and I would come down to the have little contact with people. I'd been in retreat for about 6 months, and then a Thai woman who I know and been a supporter of the monasteries there for a long time, she saw me, came over and chatted for a bit, and then asked me what do I do? And if you're in retreat in the forest, what do you do? So I sort of gave her an outline of what my day was, which is just meditation, yoga, reading, meditation, yoga, reading, have some tea, have a meal. And sort of day after day, week after week, month after month. And she looked at me and just, isn't that boring? And I said, no, not at all. But it didn't. It wasn't until after that I started reflecting on that. You know, why isn't it boring? Because on the outside, I mean, I'm not doing anything interesting at all, apparently. Just reflecting and sort of thinking, well, you know, so much of our boredom is just, you know, when we're not mindful, we're not present, and we're looking for something else to fulfill a feeling of need or a feeling of something else other than this present moment, who we are. And that's actually the story of our lives. We're constantly looking for something. And to be able to just have a time to develop that clarity of awareness, where one's actually content with what one is doing, where one is, who one is, and that's a huge gift to oneself. So and even say coming up for the teen weekend to come up and step out of your normal lives and take the time to be in a place that by worldly standards, how much more boring could you get than going to a monastery? But there's these the opportunity opens itself for something else. It's actually kind of learning, investigating, understanding oneself. So this is part of the benefit of having quiet environments to both for ourselves, but then also for others. I mean, in that, Abhayagiri is a great monastery for ourselves, but it's also the way monasteries work is that they're open to anybody who wants to come. And because we function on generosity in the sense that it's everything is supplied and supported by people's offerings and generosity, then it's also a reciprocal relationship where we offer the place and the opportunity for people who want to come and spend time. And so it's freely available. Something that reminds me that I did want to mention, it's come up a couple of times, but the something that we are also is available, freely available, are publications, books, and audio, which are, because all of that's on our website, but then also that physical books and CDs are in, there's a room right in this, where all these chairs are, there's a room at the top there that is, all those publications are there for free distribution if anybody's interested. Help yourself, take back what you want. They're there for people to use and to study from as you wish. So that's just some ideas I'm tossing out to reflect on or to consider, and just wondering if there's people have questions or would like to ask anything that help clarify what any doubts you have or uncertainties, questions. Yeah, Leo.
Actually, this is an interesting question someone asked me today. And it was actually really interesting to me. And it was basically, because on paper, like, being a Buddhist monk, well, doesn't, on paper, is not that, like, it seems kind of, like, selfish, or, like, it's not doing that much for other people.
Yeah.
And I guess the core of that, I was thinking about that, it's really interesting, because I don't believe that, but it's still an interesting question, because mm-hmm. kind of strikes what is the most meaningful impact, like, Buddhist monks have on the community. What do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, because I think, particularly from a, say, Western Protestant perspective in particular, and America's fundamentally, a Protestant culture, you got to be doing something, and it's based on works. And so that... so then, yeah, on paper, then it looks like, yeah, we're not doing anything. And but you know, I think one of the things that is lacking are real clear examples of people who are living a peaceful life, a harmonious life, a harmless life, and that example is something that is certainly worth bringing into the world and being here, and as well as that opportunity for again that. You create a place or a space that people can enter into and participate in, and because I think the general perception of of a monastery in Western culture is one of inaccessibility, sort of walls, or like many people. Even though we've been here in Redwood Valley for 20 years, and still the locals will ask, you know, oh, can you go there? Oh, can you go in? And Because that's the assumption, you see, they're monasteries or places that you can't actually go into. And that's very different in Thai culture and in Southeast Asia. Monasteries are very much a part of the kind of the web of the fabric of the society, of the culture. They're community centers. And that's also why, forest monasteries are important, because then it does step out of the whole community, communal, village impact, and then people can step out from that. But it doesn't mean people can't go there. And people do go there. They're going there all the time. So a place like, I remember the very first time that I went to stay with Ajahn Chah, my teacher. He was fairly soon after I arrived I was just visiting. I was taking a temporary ordination just to learn a bit more about Buddhism. So that was 40 odd years ago. Because similarly, I was living at a monastery, practicing meditation, studying, one of the monks asked me, "Are you going to ordain?" And it was sort of, to me, it was a strange question. You know, it was no, because I was just traveling. No way I could ordain. I couldn't live like this for the rest of my life. And because that's my perception of, a monastery, you go to a monastery, you have to live there for the rest of your life. I mean, who would want to do that? So then he just looked at me funny and sort of, no, I mean, it's ordinary in Thailand to just, for a month or 3 months, 4 months, that's really ordinary, just take a temporary ordination. So I thought, 3 or 4 months, I could do that. So that was the extent of my commitment. But then it was close to Bangkok. And then I started hearing about forest monasteries. I said, I'd like to check that out. So hearing about Ajahn Chah, so I'll go and visit that monastery. There was something that was pulling me. And then shortly after I arrived, it was a full moon in February. And in those days, that was the time when there weren't that many branch monasteries in that day, but still there was starting to be these satellite monasteries affiliated with Ajahn Chah, maybe about 15, 16 of them. So they would gather, and then all the lay people would gather. So there was, there was a couple hundred monks, and then all the lay people, hundreds and hundreds. And I was sort of, wow, this is amazing. But it was something that was quite, you could sort of see, this is really vibrant. And then you see on a weekly basis, the lay community would be, coming. One, they come every day anyway. Numbers not so much, but on a weekly basis, they're coming and listening to teachings, chanting, meditating, spending the night in the monastery, and then leaving the next morning, so that you get quite a large number of people in the monastery. So it's like And so it's just freely available. And even, say, like a place like right now, Wat Nanachat. That's an international monastery, a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's. And on a on a regular basis, there's probably, I don't know, on a daily basis, 40, 50 people show up every day, plug in the morning, and then on the weekends, of course, a lot more. And then if it's a lunar observance day, then you make 100, 200 people come and meditate, practice together. And it's quite, it's very much accessible to whoever wants to come. So that it's like creating a sanctuary that people can enter into and be supported by. And then when you create a sanctuary, you create a peaceful environment that is open to anybody, and people can come and benefit from that. Because even here, where it's still a bit of a strange, culturally, it's still a strange concept. We get, and people do come, and certainly on the weekends and on the lunar observance nights, teaching days. Tomorrow afternoon is a regular teaching. We used to be Saturday nights, and we moved it now with the new hall, then we can accommodate people. So moved it to Sunday afternoon, and there are probably numbers of people have easily tripled every week. So coming, it's not huge numbers, but it's available to anybody who wants. And then people come, and there's many people come and just walk the trails, because it's available, and people have, there's something peaceful about it. People feel that. So it's a gift to people, and they're not really asking for anything in return, which that in itself is a big a counterpoint or a alternative. Because just generally in society and culture, there's such a one, especially America, is such a competitive culture, and then if they're not competing, then you sort of what's the trick here? But it's an open generosity. So it says for people to see that there's alternatives in their life. I don't know how to take no questions at all. Surely there must be some questions. Yeah.
How closely did you and other monks live together?
How closely do we live together?
Yeah. How much time do you spend together?
Well, Yeah, that's an interesting, because we try to get a balance of having time together, and where we're interacting together, working together, and having to do ceremonies together, things like that. So there's a certain amount of time on a day, and then there's time to say, like in the afternoon, like right now, people have gone back to their dwelling places, and our cabins are kind of scattered through the forest, so that we can have time of solitude. So I try to get a balance between having time together, because there's always a certain amount of there's always issues that come up. It's natural. It's like remember Ajahn Chah saying one time, "Seems human beings, those are beings with issues." That, you know, we bring our issues together. And as I remember one monk sort of saying, yeah, living in a monastery, it's easy to start thinking that 80% of all the suffering in the world is because of the person sitting next to you. Because that's especially in our monastic structure, then who you sit next to is determined by the length of time you've been a monk. So you end up sitting next to the same person for years sometimes. you have to figure out how to live with them and. And that's one of the things that say in a monastery we don't how do you say the screening process isn't around some personality profile or something. It's more around, are they interested? Are they willing? Are they willing to follow the monastic routine? Are they willing to live by precepts? So that's your fundamental standard. And when you have that standard, then you get all sorts of different people showing up. And you have to learn to live with all sorts of different people. And because even if you have your time by yourself in the dwelling place, oftentimes what you end up doing is taking, in your mind, taking people back to your dwelling place with you. Why did he say that? Why don't I know? Why shouldn't he be? it's a very human tendency. So that time together is also learning how to not carry each other around, and learning how to live harmoniously, and learning how to relinquish our own views and opinions, our own attachments as to how we think others should be, how they if only they were like this and this and this, then I'd be happy. Which is, you know, we spend so much time in our life sort of waiting for the world to conform to our preferences, and it ain't gonna happen. So that time of being together and then being apart is times for learning in different ways. And that's so there is a certain amount of, and there is a certain amount of effort that we put into our communal living, into learning how to interact harmoniously, and that it takes work, takes attention. I think our as Westerners, we don't really have a strong cultural value of communal harmony. There's a strong value in competition and being in individuals, which has its benefits, but it also has its drawbacks in terms of learning to live together. Like, it's really interesting in the kitchen, seeing you have a large group of Westerners and you have a large group of Thais, how they move around each other. They're smooth. And it's a cultural value that they have, and that they're both in terms of just actual physicality, but then also in terms of speech and interactions. They tend to be. It's not that they don't have conflicts. I know the language too. So, but they're really good at dodging. Yeah.
So I know you said that when you first got ordained, you were just doing it to learn about Buddhism.
Yeah.
Right. So what changed for you that made you decide to fully dive in and be a monk?
I think one of the things that there's a couple things that happened. One is just internally, the experiences that I had in meditation, really kind of shifted in terms of, wow, this is possible. There's really another possibility other than my confused, wretched mind. And so that was a big deal. But then also meeting a teacher like Ajahn Chah, seeing somebody who really embodied peace and freedom and awakening. So you know, those two things together were very important, very very instrumental in making that. And it wasn't really conscious at first, and in fact, it was sort of you're always kind of hedging your bets. How can I get out of this? You know, because there's part of me is sort of like, oh wow, yeah, I should really just give myself to this and forget about anything else. And then there's another part of sort of saying, you know, okay, how do I get out of this? How do I gracefully make a departure? But just increased confidence. And it was also interesting the very first morning that I arrived at Ajahn Chah's monastery, and paid respects to him, which is what you do when you arrive at a new monastery, pay respects to the teacher, the abbot, and paid respects to him. I finished my bows. And then he just sort of looked at me for a bit, and I'm kind of not. And then he said, "You want to stay? You want to stay with me, you have to stay at least 5 years." That was the introduction I had to Ajahn Chah. And it was sort of like, you know, it's just 5 years, no way. But, you know, he just pushed my button. He's incredibly good at that. He just knew where our buttons were. and of course that reverberated in my mind over time, where I'm staying with them, and at first 5 years, because at first I was just going to pay respects to this well-known teacher, and I'll go and do this and do that, and I did. I went off, and after I don't know a few weeks maybe, then I went and stayed at a meditation monastery where I could do exactly like I wanted. I wanted to do solitary practice. I wanted to be really focused on this meditation, and I didn't really want to live in community. I didn't want to live but then as I kept practicing and kept meditating, and I got good results, but I just kept thinking of Ajahn Chah, and it was after, I don't know, 6 months, and sort of like, because I kept extending my time as well. So it was after 6 months, I go, okay, 5 years is 5 years. You got to go back to, you got to go back there. Leo.
Are you going to go see a Kuti today?
Not today. I think tomorrow we'll go for a walk. Tomorrow morning, we'll go for a walk. Take people who want to go for a walk and see the monastery. It's an opportunity to. And we were very fortunate, as we have this really pristine environment to live in. And we are here because you see where these themes of generosity come around. Where we're here in this place because there was the abbot of a Chinese Mahayana monastery. He was getting close to his death, passing away, and he. Offered us 125 acres of land to start a monastery. We'd had mutual contact back and forth, mostly Ajahn Sumedho, but the rest of our communities had time where we exchanged visits and spent time in each other's communities, but as he was approaching his death, then Master Hua, the teacher, the abbot, offered 125 acres of land. So it's actually the adjacent parcel to this one. It goes up the mountain that way, and it didn't have anything on it. Didn't have any buildings, didn't have any water, but it was a start. And then it was a gift that the land looked really rugged. And so what are we going to do with this? So I thought, well, we'll just rent a piece of property nearby and see if we can develop it, see if it's possible. So then he started checking around to see if there's a property close by, and then this property, which is right adjacent to it, was being rented out to somebody. So we figured out, okay, who owns it? And they went to the board, and Ajahn Amaro went to talk with the person who owned this property to see if we could rent it when the current renters left. And he said, well, actually, no, I'm just drawing up the papers to sell it, so you can either buy it or forget it. And so they negotiated a price, which in those days was incredibly reasonable. And it was a really adjacent parcel of another 125 acres. This property had a small house on it for some of the people who've been here before. You've seen there was the old house that was was in the middle there. It's just a little bungalow, but it was enough to start. And where you'll have your council this afternoon? That was a garage, and so it's been fixed up, and so that was what we started with, and we've been sort of developing it. And it's just really the land lends itself to say practicing meditation. It's incredibly quiet. And the forests here in California are really, really quiet. I spent all my monastic life in Thailand, and tropical forests are noisy. Yeah, it's just a lot going on. Everything's alive and competing with each other, and they're insects and birds and everything, the wildlife. It's amazing, and there's a lot going on. So here is just there's a stillness that's in the forest. It's part of the nature here, and also because it is really rugged land, then. You said wherever you can find a flat enough spot to build something, then we can we build our dwelling places, and that gives certain separation and again the ruggedness of the land. You're sort of all, even if you're fairly close by, you can feel quite separate because you're kind of you're down around or you're around a little knoll or something. There. Yeah.
What do you think was the hardest thing to give up?
The hardest thing to give up?
Yeah.
For me, the hardest thing to give up was for family. Close family, very close family ties, and not just with my parents and siblings, but a sort of extended family. So that was a big thing. I can remember I hadn't moved here to America. I hadn't even thought of that then. It was probably 1993 or something. A Thai woman invited me to accompany her and some of her relatives, plus a couple senior Thai monks. She'd wanted to take them to Canada. So I said, I'd love to go. I can visit my family. I can visit other relatives of mine. And so we had a itinerary, and I had relatives everywhere, and just checked in with them because I didn't when I went to live in Thailand and ordained as a monk, I didn't get back to Canada for like 16 years, over 16 years. So it was a long time to be away. So yeah, for me it was family. For others it would probably be something different, but. Yeah.
So I asked this to Ajahn Jyotipala a while, but there wasn't that much time.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of slightly complicated question. It has to do with the don't take what's not offered.
Uh-huh.
And how that would play out in, say, like really repressive societies. Or say, like, I was watching this documentary a while ago, and it was in some country in Latin America, I don't remember which one, but the village's local water supply was privatized by Nestle.
Uh-huh.
And a law was passed making it illegal to collect rainwater.
Uh-huh.
So it was like the cost of water went up 700%.
Yeah.
And everyone was basically had to work for Nestle.
Yep.
And that would that count as taking what's not offered?
Well, I mean, that's It would, yeah. I mean, that's how they make their money. It's why they're incredibly wealthy multinational corporation. That's how it works. But that's also, you know, there's things that are legal. And then there's things that are maybe moral, you know, and you know, you have to be really careful how you start, you know, because you can't sort of interpret things on your own all the time. You need to have some kind of, because also say like. Say when I lived in Thailand, and then there were, you know, because there's so much more contact between the monasteries and the society, the culture around, then a lot more involvement in social issues, and monasteries tend to be looked to as guides for on social issues. So that involved in things like that of resources that are public and are being intruded upon by people who are businesses so that how to make. To advocate for people who don't have power against people who do have power. Those are issues that certainly I've dealt with learned from. So that, yeah, certainly those are aspects. A lot of what I was involved in were things of like protecting land, protecting forests, protecting the local resources, because outside businesses were coming in and buying up things, or were coming in logging, stripping the land. Helping to organize people.
Yeah, it seems, because I asked Anuj Dipala, like, it seems like a fine line between, because in, like, my own personal, like, views, like, I'm kind of against a lot of private property, like, I think it's kind of a weird concept, and so I guess it's just keeping, especially when I'm also interested, like, interested in activism, and mm-hmm. I guess recently I've been thinking a lot about, like, activism, but like based on like the precepts and the Buddhist Foundation.
Yeah.
And how that would look like in societies where there's like a lot of unjust, you know, the water supply is bought up and privatized.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't matter which society, there are lots of unjust things. And you don't have to go very far in America to find what is unjust. But a lot of it is being able to, because there's a lot more power in like a harmonious, virtuous foundation to go against. It's hard for people to, especially when you can pull people together around that. Oftentimes people will back down, or they're, especially if they're, because it just makes them look so bad. But you have to be really careful. You have to be really discerning. You can't, just because you think you're right, doesn't mean anything if you're you also have to be able to have kind of, yeah, like a harmonious support or foundation that people can accept, and that's really important. So that what I was doing, and it's also just, you know, learning how to say, you know, how does it work? What are the power dynamics here? So I remember one time, I was just starting, being offered this piece of land, really beautiful forest, and start a branch monastery because I was wanted to protect that land. And then and I'd gone and looked at it, and then came back to bring some monks to stay, and this chainsaw's going, and they're cutting down these areas of just pristine, like first growth area of hardwoods. And it was right near the spring that where we were would be our water supply, and talk to the cutters, and you know, the cutters, I mean, they're just trying to get by, and so talk, okay, who hired you, who are you working for? Okay, it's the kind of the head man of this. The village, and I said, okay, when's he come and get his log? So I go and see when he comes. I go and sit out on the pile of logs that are waiting to be picked up, and wait for him to show up and start talking to him, saying, you know, this land was just given to me, and where he was cutting was actually in national park land, That was one of the things that was a way for me to protect this national park area because it was right on the border. And I sort of started talking with him and he sort of said, I can't stop now. I've already paid off the police. I paid off the forestry already. I'm in debt. So my... Yeah, that's how it works. And you sort of, okay, what are the power dynamics? And then you figure that out. And then, who isn't on the take? And who isn't involved? Who would be interested to help out? And at that point, I was able to find a senior military officer who was really clean. He was really wanted to help, so he was able to stop. But so you got to figure, you got to take time. You can't say, "Well, it's the wrong thing to do," and you get into a fight with them because they got, and especially in that area where I was. I mean, they've got all the guns. And I remember telling the monks, you know, don't obstruct anybody. Don't go in there, and especially some righteous kind of Westerner coming in and trying to tell them to get lost. It was a good way to get shot. So you just have to figure out ways to do it. And so we're able to. And of course, that takes time. And it did take time, and we were still able to protect it. It's still protected to this day. Why don't we have a little break? I see people need a little bit of a bio breaks as well as just a little bit of a walk. 10 minutes, come back. Okay, so we've had a bit of a break. There was a couple hands going up just before the break. Has anybody still have the questions? Yes.
If you could give your younger self one piece of information, what would it be?
Myself?
Yeah.
I think probably the biggest advice that I'd give myself would, a lot of it is, you know, don't worry. Don't worry. Don't sweat the small stuff. And that, you know, it's such a tendency for all of us. I mean, we all have different habits, but, you know, I think for myself, my own habit and tendency was around worry, fear, doubt, and so that sense of it's not worth it. You know, there's obviously some healthy concerns that one should have from time to time, but still, you know, we tend to get overly worried or overly concerned, and you know, we've got the means to deal with whatever. Yeah.
What were you like when you were 18?
What was I like when you have to ask some of my friends? you know, I was like probably most normal. Well, not really. I mean, in the sense, most normal 18-year-olds, probably it's not easily defined. And, you know, I think for myself at 18, confused, uncertain what to do, is just going off to university, you know, trying this, trying that, and but also, you know, I think there was, you know, there was also something that was really internally sort of pulling me somewhere other than what I was having to deal with or put up with, you know, in the sense that I was really looking for an alternative, so that was something that was going percolating underneath all the time, and I was you know, at 18, all sorts of you know, just the normal things of you know, wasting time. 18. Hadn't started into drugs yet. well, in those days, it wasn't, and where I came from, just wasn't around. So I made up for it after. but you know, just you know, typical sort of, especially for growing up north, where I grew up, a lot of alcohol. Just as part of the culture, and trying to figure out how to have a girlfriend, how to keep a girlfriend, how to get rid of a girlfriend. Just, you know, it's, you know, it's just the typical stuff. You know, where you're just confused.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's lots in the suttas where the Buddha talks about what are you know, what are the foundations for a really stable relationship, stable family, stable basis of communication and love within a relationship. I mean, the Buddha was asked all sorts of questions. And he gave, and he also how to maintain a relationship. It was like this couple who were happily married and had been married together for who knows how long, 50 years, 60 years, and then, you know, we've been happy all our lives. How do we find each other in future lives? And the Buddha gave advice. So, no, it's not an unknown topic in the Theravada Buddha's canon. You know, so much of it is it comes back to the fundamental principles of the basis of you know, what is it that lays a basis of confidence, virtue, a generosity, kindness, wisdom, discernment. You know, those are all the qualities that are needed in order to have a stable and loving relationship. So those are important qualities to be making conscious. Yeah.
I don't know if the teens or anyone else here has heard about your environmental work in Thailand. Is that something you want to work
about? I talked a little bit about it just tangentially.
It's just the reason I'm curious, particularly. I think it's very. I didn't know that about you for a long time. About what an impact you have on Thailand with that work, and the context being that we're all living in a time of tremendous environmental, uncertainty and fear. And I've been wanting to hear someone like you talk about some of the qualities of the heart, qualities of inner strength that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean it's really it is important to have an attitude and perspective that you can hold that, because if you dwell too much on the statistics, it can be really depressing. I remember one time, you know, I'd been involved and helping many different projects and then starting different projects, and then remember somebody asking me quite outright, because a lot of it was to do with protecting of forests, but also in order to protect forests in Thailand, you also have to build a village structure and autonomy so that they can take responsibility for it, so it can't be imposed. Asking, you know, do you think we're going to be able to protect forests in Thailand? And I said, no. I said, well, why do you do this? You know, if you don't think it can be done. I said, well, the thing is, the forces for destruction are really powerful, but you can't approach it from that kind of rational place. You have to pay attention to what's really important for yourself and the world around you, and you have to put your energy there rather than elsewhere. And it's because one does that for oneself and then encourages others and is an example for others, that other people will pick that up and get on board. And also, I said, you know, in terms of the, especially in terms of the, at that time, that was probably late 1980s when that happened, early 1990s, I said, you know, we're really not doing it for this generation. This generation is locked into the destruction and capitalizing everything. Said, you want to do it for the next generation, the generation after, because you want to preserve examples so that they can see that and they can be inspired by it and pick that up. And that's something that I've seen. You know, so now I'm older, time has passed. You really see that in Thailand, certainly, where there's far more awareness around environmental issues. I mean, not just around forests, but a tremendous amount of interest in stepping back from chemical, because it's an agricultural country, and the chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides have a huge effect, but there's a real strong movement for organic uses, and you saw that at Bunya Pratib. They're just doing great examples, and it's a school, a residential school where city kids are learning about growing up and living in the countryside. And it's a great, and it's a science project. So I mean, they're really learning science, but then they're really learning about food and food supply. That's quite. Yeah.
Food waste and big jugs of biofuel that they make from vegetable oil.
It's really, really interesting. So there's lots of stuff like that going on. And, I would just read something of a monk, Sri Lankan monk, who I know. He was visiting Sri Lanka and visiting a friend of his. He hadn't visited him for a while, and it was up in the area around Kandy, and he was at their monastery, and the couple of the novices were out doing some work in the on the grounds. And they had their upper robes off, and I said, both of these novices had these big scars on their back, and he said, what's going on with those novices? They've got these scars. He said, they donated their kidneys, and. Anyway, it turns out many areas of Sri Lanka, huge numbers of people are dealing with kidney failure, and because of the chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and it's overwhelming their systems, and the monastics, especially if they're like fairly young, or if they've grown up in the monastery since they're young, then they haven't been exposed to it's like when you're in an agricultural area, then people's kidneys are falling apart, and it's endemic, it's like an epidemic in Sri Lanka, areas of Sri Lanka, and many of the monastics are donating kidneys to keep people alive, keep relatives alive, keep other villagers alive. So it's how hopeless is that? But what it does is also create a sense of the monasteries then become. A force for spreading that news and setting that example, and so then there's much more understanding of how it works. Thailand is certainly one of the reasons. It isn't just because they taste better that there's people are getting interested in organic food, it's because so many people are dying of the poisons that are in it. Those are you know, that's the opposite side. You know, oh, people are learning, and you can learn, and you can change. And even something like say where maybe forests have been destroyed or have been compromised, and if they're protected even a little bit, then they'll flourish again. So, I mean, you went into Tao Dam, which is a place along the border of Cambodia and Thailand, Burma, still in Thailand. And the monk who's sitting here was the abbot of that monastery. And I had started that years ago, because I'd seen it when it was pristine, and I went back about 8 or 10 years later, and it's changed so much, and so much. And then as time went on, I started to go in there and start helping out, and I just talk to people and gather information, and you start getting a sense of where the illegal logging is happening, where the illegal hunting is taking place, because it really is pristine in terms of tropical jungle, tropical forest that still has elephants and tigers living in it. But then, over time, you know, we've been working there, having monks stay there, getting a sense of who where the power is, how to draw other people in to help. And probably the last time I went in was about 4 years ago, and it was just made me so happy to go in and see roads that I knew were logging roads that grown over. Roads that were areas where the hunters would go out to hunt. They're grown over. And so that the forest is just sort of coming back. And if you do that, then of course especially that Dao Dam, because it really is pristine, then those areas of forest can and wildlife can expand, and then people, of course, the new generation sees the value in protecting that. They're really concerned that they're losing their heritage. I think a lot of it is just learning how to live simply, learning how to live simply, learning how to be content with. You don't have to wear a hair shirt and you know, just sort of harangue everybody. It's more like the more we learn how to live simply, learn how to attune to a certain contentment, and then that in itself, because it's so much of it's fed by the economics of desire, and is really radical to be somebody who's content with little. a lot of what I did in Thailand as well was around communication. The being able to train people and empower people to communicate. So that learning how to communicate, like especially on a village level, training younger people, the women, the girls, how to communicate to officials, how to communicate with others, how to communicate in terms of radio, television, nowadays, or when I was there, it was more radio, television, sort of internet is now another means of communication. Just learning how to do that. So a lot of it is, it'd be a feeling confident to do that, and then people start to connect with each other, and then that's when it starts happening. When people start connecting with each other. Yeah.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about being ordained and being
monk? Selfish. That it's a selfish thing. I think that's it's a fairly common understanding. One, that it's selfish, and one, that it's easy. You know, that you're just taking the easy way. if you really wanted to be enlightened, why don't you do it more in a more challenging way? Be the bodhisattva that does this and does that and does everything. So, well, maybe not. So, I mean, that's a certain misconception. But I think the biggest one around it, that it's selfish. Only concerned with ourselves. And, and that was part of what I was talking with earlier. How much, in order to, like, for somebody who is really selfish, they can't live here. You couldn't live here if you were selfish, because it's just too uncomfortable and unpleasant. You're the expectation and the reality of having to share and give and be a part of something would be too uncomfortable. And that's really interesting. When I remember, there's a very famous teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he's not so well known in the West. Great scholar, great meditator, huge impact in Thailand, and. He had an incredibly organized mind, so that he would take a theme and teach on that theme every week, like months, years sometimes. He did years. He took just dependent origination. He taught every week dependent origination, like years, 3 years, 4 years, and it was just coming at it from all different angles. Then, for some reason, it'd change and be some other theme. And I went to pay respects to him shortly before he passed away. I mean, like a year or so before he passed away. He passed away in his early 80s. So he was getting older. I knew he was getting older. I wanted to go pay respects, and I asked him. Said, you tend to teach around certain themes, and I'm just wondering, as it's getting toward the end of your life now, what theme are you emphasizing? And he said, ah, nah, I'm so old. He said, I don't have time to teach too much. He said, I just keep telling people, don't be selfish. That was really sweet. And it really is the kind of the heart of any kind, any religious practice, any spiritual practice. Yeah, there was a hand up over there. Greatest desire as a kid, wow, would depend on the flavor of the week. I think that was probably one of the reasons that kept pulling me this way, is that nothing really grabbed me, you know, in the sense that I just didn't have this burning desire to do anything particular, be anything particular, but I really wanted to understand, I really wanted to find something peaceful or true. So maybe that's my biggest desire. But it's hard to sort of articulate that when you're young. Sort of, wow, I must be some sort of screwed up mess. You know? There are, and that is very, very much a part of our lifestyle. I remember listening to Ajahn Sujito is one of the monks in our lineage, and he was starting a monastic retreat, and he's very droll. He has a very droll sense of humor, and he said, "Well, this is supposed to be a monastic retreat, but it's not really. We're not really monastic in that sense. We're much more. If we're going to call it something true, this would be a cenobitic, peripatetic, mendicant retreat." So cenobitic is living in community, but peripatetic is wandering. So that we're it's very much a part of the tradition. And in the West, our roots are very much. One of the monks from that ordained here, he's wandering around New England, has been for the last 2-3 years. He checks in with, there's a new monastery there, and then another monk in New York. So every once in a while he checks in with them. But he's just sort of out there wandering without any fixed destination, and just seeing that's taking it on as a training, and because you when you're wandering like that, you don't want to be carrying too much, gets burdensome, and you really have to be ready to adapt to the circumstances that you find yourself in. So for in our tradition, you'd need to, before you start doing that, you don't just sort of get your ordination, get your robes, and then head off down the road. You really have to have a foundation in the training, so that say 5 years of the fully ordained monk training. So he did that. He did his time as a Anagarikan white novice monk training, and then he headed off. So he's been a monk now. This would be his 8th year. I haven't heard yet where he is right now. Because whatever the case, even if you're wandering like that during this period of the summertime would coincide with the, say in Asia would be the monsoon season. So then you have to be, you have to have a fixed abode. Just the protection from the elements. And then monks here have gone just off wandering a couple of weeks. Just one, a couple of the monks will go. Usually I won't let monks wander on their own at first. You have a bit of practice going with others. So there's a couple of monks who just go off, go out here and walk up Tomka Road and come back a couple of weeks later. You hear the stories. there was a couple of the monks. JP, what? Titapo and Yaniko. They walked from Abhayagiri up to the new hermitage outside of Portland. Mm-hmm. And you just, you go with your alms bowl and as little gear as possible, because it's, you're trying to get that balance where you've got enough to keep you warm and dry, but then you have to carry it all, and so you're careful. And then your alms bowl. So then you, and then every day you walk for alms. One of the things for monks, we can't actually ask for anything. So we can't, come into a town or a village or, I'm so hungry, please give me some food. You can't ask. What you can do is make yourself available for people's generosity. And America's great to go to do that in, because Americans will just, who are you? What are you doing? So then you can tell them. You can't sort of advertise yourself or ask for anything overtly. And we can't store food, so that whatever you're given today, you have to relinquish. Tomorrow's another day. We can't use money, carry money. So we don't have any money. You can't buy anything. So you really are dependent on people's generosity. Yeah.
Have you broken any?
And if so,
which ones?
Well, the thing is, there's lots of them. I mean, we've got a lot of precepts, and the precept that gets broken most frequently is invariably around speech. Either harsh speech or gossip, things like that. They're hard. Whether you're a monastic or you're a layperson, those are hard. So those are ones that get taken. But I remember when I very first time I went back to Canada and was visiting over at my uncle and aunt's, and then there's other uncles and aunts there, and my grandfather and my parents, and so everybody's gathering. And if there's a gathering in our family, then there's all sorts of alcohol and whatnot. So, my uncle sort of said, "How can I get you a drink?" And I said, "Well, I've already got one. I had a Pepsi or something." No, I mean a drink. And he said, "I've got some really good Canadian club." I said, "No, as a monk, I can't, I don't don't drink alcohol. And he said, well, you're over here, nobody'd know. And I said, yeah, well, nobody would know, but I would know. I'm somebody. So in terms of that sense of, oh, well, nobody would know. Well, is that, what does that put oneself at? Because you have to know yourself. Gossip. Well, a lot of it is like tale bearing, and usually like telling something about this person over to that person in order to, you know, either to convey something that is, even if it's true, it is something that is going to lift what you're trying to get yourself lifted up in their eyes, and trying to put somebody else down or create some kind of division in some way. So that's a good kind of definition. Yeah, because because it's definitely the case in a sense of talking about somebody who's not there, and conveying something that is you trying to score some points for yourself in some way, and at the expense of somebody else. It's not, it's not very beautiful. That's one of the things that I really put a lot of emphasis on. So, like training in our community, because it's something that I notice that, in communities or in monastic communities where, there's not a whole lot of things to do, that people talk. And it can be really corrosive. So, and that was, Ajahn Siripanyo came, and because he hasn't ever been here. He's visited, but he hasn't lived here before. So it was one thing was very heartwarming for me. He said, I really like being here because there isn't any gossip.
Is the point of the precepts, which I guess is an ethical code that you live by,
mm-hmm.
is the point simply to create as much well-being and as little pain in your environment as possible?
That's a good working definition or working function. Because that really is the function of the precepts is really to create a sense of ease and well-being, and decrease the conflict and complication that we human life tends to be fraught with. Also, in terms of one of the functions of the precepts, as precepts are being held and being lived, they create a bond of trust between individuals or communities, and of course that's happiness and well-being there. But it is interesting to see the sense of trust that is created, and to recognize that's a real benefit to living with human beings you can trust, and then to be in contact with trust, and to be able to generate trust. Yeah.
So, is the philosophy of the community here totally against fun? Like the idea of like the kind of really wholesome fun that you can get out of just throwing a ball or having an ice cream cone, but not for the sake of meditation, just for the sake of enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there a space for kind of enjoyment?
There's a space for enjoyment, but it's very it might not be recognizable by people in the world. in the sense that there's there's a real enjoyment of being in the company of good people. There's a real enjoyment of being in environments that are really pleasing, in the sense of nature, so those are things that are, but so that the, and that's actually, I think there's a certain refinement that starts to develop around enjoying subtle aspects of the human condition that are actually accessible to us all the time, and we miss it. Yeah, so.
I kind of have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Because some of these complications that you guys talk about,
yeah,
things that the precepts try to avoid, I feel are also, they can be really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is you have to remember that it's our precepts, it's not yours. in the sense that they're not a statement about anybody else. They're opportunities for us, for somebody who wants to give that a try or to use it for a period of time in order to... But it's not... It's not like a moral judgment. It's more like an opportunity. So then, picking them up are completely voluntary in the sense that you couldn't force anybody to live like this. And they have to want to do it. They have to want to be here. Sexual misconduct in the third precept is outside of stepping outside the bounds of an established relationship that one has but then also there's aspects of it that are around maybe like power dynamics. Age or position, so that if those positions are taken advantage of in some way, that's the Buddha talks about that in terms of not having engaging in sexual activity with somebody who's a minor or who is betrothed or who is promised or is. So that there are those bounds of propriety or maybe like a power dynamic in some ways as well, where somebody is able to manipulate a situation because of their age or position. So then that's something that the Buddha points to as inappropriate, along with stepping outside of an established relationship. I need to have a quick break to use the loo, and I'll be right back. Yeah, Liam.
In the final, like when all the solar panels are put in,
yeah.
How much of the monastery's electricity needs will be met?
Still uncertain. We have to put them in and see. We're by our calculations 100%. Will be solar, but that's our calculations. Whether the calculations are right or not, because our use of the building is still so new, and then also we changed the provider. PG&E is not our provider anymore. So it's all sort of in flux, but we're hopefully within the next couple of weeks we'll get all the last of the solar panels up. I don't know. I'm hoping it's in September. That was my understanding. So,
if you guys produce extra electricity, are you allowed to sell it back to the grid? Monastery as a whole can? Or?
I don't think anybody can.
Because I know, like,
that's.
If you own solar panels, the excess energy goes back to the grid and you get reimbursed for that.
You get reimbursed to the point of zero. Whatever extra goes to the utility company.
Because there's this person in the Oakland Hills,
yeah.
And she has like windmills or whatever, but she stopped using electricity, I think it was solar, but she actually stopped using electricity, so her stuff, her renewables were just going into the grid, and then she was just getting paid, essentially.
Well, if she is the PG&E will fix that pretty quick. Yes, so.
I just have a quick question. When's your birthday?
My birthday is July 26th.
Are you a Cancer?
Hmm?
Are you a Cancer?
No. It's a Leo. Yes. Sometimes they do. If they have any skill, sometimes I've been. It's a very ordinary thing, especially in Thailand. Especially massaging a senior monk, and it's a nice occasion to be, you know, a few people sit around and massage the senior monk, and it's a very informal time. So it's a time of making connection and then asking questions, and it's a nice time. But yeah, I've been subjected to some awful massages. Very well-meaning, but there are some monks who do actually have some skill. It happens, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if technically I'm allowed to ask this, but I was wondering, what do you think of President right now, Donald Trump?
Well, you know, one of our precepts is around right speech.
Okay.
I think it's helpful to exercise right speech. I mean, it's a very unfortunate situation. I mean, I don't think that whether one likes them or not, that's what you're stuck with right now, and that's learning how to identify the ways in which one can be contribute skillfully to the people around the world or the atmosphere around, because there is such a tremendous amount of fear and negativity being generated, that I think it's important to be consciously figuring out ways to be able to support each other as human beings and as citizens, so that there's an effort being made to finding some ways of bringing something positive into the circumstances, into the society, into the culture. It's so important. I think it's having a person like President Trump, it's easy to it's an easy target, but sometimes those easy targets aren't very helpful in finding skillful ways of directing our energy and attention. Yeah, those are the major ones.
So I know a few of them, and I know some of them are widely known, killing or stealing or engaging in sexual misconduct. And you've mentioned a few other ones that I didn't know, like not storing food and preventing not driving. There's several like that, not meddling money, but people do tend to know about. I'm curious, what precepts are in there that most people don't know about that actually might have a big impact on your life or on monastic living?
Certainly in terms of monastic living, there's a lot of the precepts are around the relationship with the lay community, so that both establishing it's sort of bonds of trust and not taking advantage of the generosity or the requisites that have been offered. So then it extends into a lot of precepts around looking after the requisites that are given, both of the, say, whether it's medicines or food or lodgings or robes. So there's actually a lot of precepts around that. So it's what it's doing is establishing these relationships of respect and trust between the monastic community and the lay community. And that has a huge effect when those are sort of taken in terms of what is the spirit behind it. One is the mindfulness that you gain in being attentive and careful in one's use of the requisites, but then also that establishing of both a harmonious and trustful relationship between the monastic communities and the lay community. So those are precepts, and there's, you know, there's lots of them that come in different ways, and it does really establish this, like a really trustworthy community and trustworthy human being, because we, you know, we have to internalize. It's not just the community; it's we have to internalize that within ourselves. Yeah. There's no precept against having a wrong thought. You can't mandate that, which is very different from Catholicism. Every 2 weeks, on the full moon and the new moon, the monastic community gathers. And we do a recitation of our rules of training. So those 227 rules are recited, and one monk who has committed it to memory will recite it. And it's a ceremony, it's a ritual, but before engaging in that or beginning it, then you have to clear off any offenses, and you also have to, you can't confess if two monks have committed the same offense, they can't confess it to each other. So before you do a confession, then you have to sort of say, what did I do? And then a monk said, oh, well, I did that too. So then I'll have to confess to another monk. So there is a formal procedure of going through one's offenses and letting others know, and then doing a confession, and it's heard by the other monk, who then responds in a way of saying, okay, very well, determined to do better in the future. So it's on a certain level it's a ritual, but it's also a developing of an awareness around the rule. So it isn't just going in and listening to the ceremony and getting out as quick as you can. So there is and like during this 3 month period of the summertime, which coincides with the, say, like in Thailand or in Asia, of the rains retreat, monsoon season, then we go through the whole community, monastic community. We study the rules of training. We go through. We tend not to go through them all in terms of because it's in 3 months you can't do it. But over, like, we'll focus on something this year. Then next year we'll focus on something else. And there's some that are really important that you really want to make sure people understand. But it's a period of group study and learning, so that everybody's got a good grasp of what they are and how to use them, especially when you're in a group like that. And what I do is I tend to get the more junior members of the community to do the presentations. Say, rather than me sitting up and rattling off the rules, I mean, that's just really boring. But getting the younger members and then splitting it up so that it's not too much for one person, and then they'll study them and then present it, and they've got to learn it, and then people be asking questions. So it's very interactive, and people learn a lot from it. So it's a part of our almost a defining feature of our lifestyle, really. So that getting a good grasp of these is, you know, to say rules is sort of saying, you know, it's like, you know, do this, don't do that, which, you know, it is on a certain level, but it's also, it has so many applications and implications that though having that good understanding of the kind of the structure that holds together a monastic life, and there's a clarity there, then the mind, the heart is really able to settle much more clearly. There's a confidence that arises in what one's doing. So then that's really helpful for one's ongoing, say, meditation and investigation. It is 3:33, which is it's a time for you all to have a break, a bit of a rest, walk around, and then 4 o'clock you'll gather for council over in the hall over there. So feel free to get yourselves settled. Everybody else knows that you're going to be there, so, I mean, in terms of the monastics, so you won't be bothered, it'll be empty there. And it's closed off. So, okay, great.